And the reading on page 960, and it's Mark 11, beginning at verse 27. They arrived again in Jerusalem, and while Jesus was walking in the temple courts, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders came to him. "By what authority are you doing these things?" they asked. "And who gave you the authority to do this?" Jesus replied, "I will ask you one question. Answer me, and I will tell you by what authority I am doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? Tell me." They discussed it among themselves and said, "If we say from heaven, he will ask, then why don't you believe him? But if we say of human origin..." They feared the people, for everyone held that John really was a prophet. So they answered Jesus, "We don't know." Jesus said, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things."
Thank you, Nat. Now, before Nat comes to bring us the second part of that reading, I just wanted to explain why we're doing it in two parts and give you a little bit of insight into what goes on in terms of sermon preparation. Because when this term's preaching rotas were first circulated, I saw that I was down to preach on the passage that Nat has just read for us last Sunday evening. And so I did what I usually do when I'm about to prepare a sermon. I read the passage, and then I will read it again, and read around it, and read about it. But I found it quite a difficult passage to get into, to work out exactly what it might be that God wanted to say to us through this passage. Because if I'm honest, I thought it was a rather strange passage. It's not just me. Did anyone else get that impression that when you first read it, as we just did, it seems to be an account of an occasion when Jesus is just being uncooperative? They ask him a question, so he replies by asking them a question. They don't answer his question, so he won't answer theirs. That's it. And it just sounds a little bit childish, really, doesn't it? A bit petulant, you know. What's it all about? So I continued mulling it over, and to be honest, just reading the passage itself, it didn't get any clearer. So I did what I always advise preachers to do when I run the preacher's workshop here at St. Bees, which is read a significant chunk before and a significant chunk after the passage, and then you'll see the bigger picture. So I did that, and particularly reading the bit that follows in Mark chapter 12, verses 1 to 12, which is the passage that Henry was due to preach on this Sunday morning. When I read that passage in Mark chapter 12, I realized what the problem was. And the problem is the chapters. Because, you see, the chapters that we have in our Bible were not there originally. In fact, it wasn't until 1227 AD that the man who was then the Archbishop of Canterbury, a man called Stephen Langton, added the chapters to the Bible. On the screen, you'll see a statue of Stephen Langton in Canterbury Cathedral. And it was Stephen Langton, as Archbishop of Canterbury, who added the chapters to the Bible. Before that, other than the Psalms that were divided up, there weren't any chapters in the Bible. And if you're interested, and even if you're not, I'll tell you, the verses weren't added until 1550. And whilst it's actually quite useful for us to have chapters and verses, because it helps us to find our way around the Bible much more easily, sometimes they can be a hindrance. Because what they lead us to believe is that at the end of a chapter must be the end of a section, and the next chapter must be beginning something different. And so because we get to the end of chapter 11, we think, oh, that's the end of that story. And then we read chapter 12, and we think, well, that must be a new story. But it isn't. The chapter break between chapter 11 and chapter 12 of Mark's Gospel is entirely artificial, and the story goes on into chapter 12, right to verse 12. And so once I realized that it was all part of one package, it was a lot easier. So now, Nat's going to come and read for us the second part of the reading. And just to give the sense of continuity, she'll read the last part of the first reading and then go straight on into the second part of the reading, and we'll take it from there. Thank you, Nat.
Starting at verse 33. So they answered Jesus, "We don't know." And Jesus said, "Neither will I tell you by what authority I am doing these things." Jesus then began to speak to them in parables. A man planted a vineyard. He put a wall round it, dug a pit for the wine press, and built a watchtower. Then he rented the vineyard to some farmers and moved to another place. At harvest time, he sent a servant to the tenants to collect from them some of the fruit of the vineyard. But they seized him, beat him, and sent him away empty-handed. Then he sent another servant to them. They struck this man on the head and treated him shamefully. He sent still another, and that one they killed. He sent many others. Some of them they beat, others they killed. He had one left to send, a son whom he loved. He sent him last of all, saying, "They will respect my son." But the tenants said to one another, "This is the heir. Come, let's kill him, and the inheritance will be ours." So they took him and killed him and threw him out of the vineyard. What then will the owner of the vineyard do? He will come and kill those tenants and give the vineyard to others. Haven't you read this passage of Scripture? The stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it is marvelous in our eyes. Then the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders looked for a way to arrest him, because they knew he had spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away.
Thank you once again. So now we've got the whole passage, the whole story from beginning to end, and I think it makes a little bit more sense. And so having done that, I spoke with Henry, who was due to be preaching this morning, and found out that he was actually going to be on holiday all week and would have to come back and prepare a sermon. And so we agreed, actually, we'd combine the two passages together, and I would preach on both passages last Sunday evening and this Sunday morning, so Henry didn't have to come back from holiday and prepare a sermon. And so if you were at the 7 o'clock service last Sunday evening, remember, you were warned that if you came this morning, you'd get the same sermon again. And you're here this morning, so you obviously feel like you need to hear it all over again. Let's look at the passage then. First of all, let's ask the question, who's asking Jesus the question at the beginning of the passage? Mark tells us actually both at the beginning and at the end of the passage who it was. Because at the beginning we read that it was the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders who came to him. And then right at the end of the passage, that second bit that Nat just read for us, we read, then the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders looked for a way to arrest him. So they're mentioned at the beginning, at the end of the passage, and we know who they are. And when we read that list, it might seem to us like almost a random list. These three groups of people all happen to turn up at the same time. But they're not just three random groups of people, because these three groups of people together are the groups that made up the Jewish ruling council known as the Sanhedrin. The Romans, who ruled the area generally, allowed the Sanhedrin to act as the governing body over Judea. And the Sanhedrin met in a chamber within the temple. As a representation on the screen of what it might have looked like, and you see a little diagram and a little bit that's shaded in yellow that's called the Chamber of Hewn Stone. And that's where the Sanhedrin met. Their headquarters, their council chamber, as it were, was in the temple. And they were allowed by the Romans to rule over the area. They were the chief priests. That would mean the current high priest, who we know was Caiaphas. Any previous high priests, we know that his predecessor was a man called Annas, and any other members of the high priestly families would form part of the Sanhedrin. And then there were the teachers of the law. These were the rabbis, the people who had been trained in how to interpret the Old Testament law and how to apply it to people's lives. They were in the Sanhedrin. And then there were the elders, the senior men in the land, the tribal and family heads, who, because they were that little bit older, were considered to be wise and therefore able to bring guidance to the people. And together, these three groups, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders, made up the Sanhedrin, the Jewish ruling council. And so under the oversight of Rome, within Judea, this group were the highest political authority. They acted as sort of a local government council. They were the political authority in this area. They were the highest political authority. They were also the highest legal authority in Judea. They sat as a court. They were a supreme court, and they would hear cases, and they would pass sentence on people who were accused of breaking the law. And so they were the highest legal authority in the area. And then they were the highest religious authority in Judea. They were responsible for making sure that God's law was kept, that everything in the temple happened as it should happen properly. They were the highest religious authority. So this group of people, the Sanhedrin, the chief priests, the teachers of the law, and the elders, they are in charge. They have authority in Judea. Now, it's unlikely, but not impossible, that the entire Sanhedrin came en masse to see Jesus. There were about 70 members of this Jewish ruling council. So it's not impossible that they all came, but probably what is more likely is that representatives of the ruling council came to speak with Jesus. So now that we know who they are, we can see, well, what question do they ask? And the question that they ask makes more sense now that we know who they are. They are the ones in authority. They're the highest authority in the land, politically, legally, and spiritually. And so they come to Jesus and say, "By what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you authority to do this?" Now, they phrased it as a question. But actually, I don't think it really is a question. But let's unpack it a little bit more. They're particularly asking him about these things. Who gave you authority to do this? And by what authority are you doing these things? So what are these things that they're talking about? Well, to understand that, you have to go back to the bits before the passage and read that chunk. If you've got a church Bible, you just look at the chapter headings, and you can see what has happened immediately before this. So page 960, the chapter heading there is Mark 11, verses 1 to 11. Jesus comes to Jerusalem as king. The events of what we now call Palm Sunday, where Jesus is greeted by the crowds as king. Remember, the Sanhedrin is the highest political authority in Judea. And Jesus has just ridden into the capital of Judea, Jerusalem, and being greeted by all the people as king, who is coming to establish the kingdom of our father David. And then the next day, the next chapter heading, page 960, we read Mark 11, 12 to 26, Jesus clears the temple courts. It's the passage that Mike Pavlou preached on here last Sunday morning. Let's just remind ourselves what happened. Jesus entered the temple courts and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers and the benches of those selling doves and would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. The Sanhedrin is the highest religious authority. Their base is in the temple. They're responsible for what happens in the temple. And Jesus has just gone into the temple, their territory, and overturned the tables of the money changers and not allowed anyone to carry their merchandise through the temple. He's gone in and taken charge. He's gone in and exercised authority in their area. And as if that weren't enough, he then taught from the Old Testament law. It says he taught them, "Is it not written, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations?" And so he picks up this passage in Isaiah, and he starts teaching from the law. That was the domain of the teachers of the law. That's why they were called teachers of the law, because they taught the law. And here's Jesus doing their job in their temple. Jesus has just spent the last 2 days blatantly and deliberately treading on their toes, going into their patch, the temple, taking authority which they thought they had, doing their job for them, teaching the law. So it's not at all a surprise when we read, the chief priests and the teachers of the law began looking for a way to kill him, for they feared him, because the whole crowd was amazed at his teaching. And so the passage that we read today is actually telling us this is the first part of their plan to get rid of Jesus. They don't like what he's doing, and they've decided they need to get rid of him, and now they're putting their plan into action. And so when they come to Jesus, as I said, they ask him a question, but it isn't really a question. It's an accusation. I don't really think they were expecting an answer. I think they thought they were on such solid ground that they would never get an answer, because it's not a question, it's an accusation. It's a little bit like as if somebody today, if you saw somebody behaving in a way as if they had an authority that they didn't have, you might say to them, "Who do you think you are? You're not really asking a question, are you? You're making it in the form of a question, but really what you're saying is, you're not in charge here." Or the other old classic, "Who died and made you king? What right have you got to take control here?" And I think that's what they're doing here. They're phrased as questions, but really they're accusations. They're coming to Jesus and they're saying, "What right have you got to do these things?" So I guess they were probably quite surprised when Jesus actually answered them. If someone says to you, "Who do you think you are?" and you answer them, that's not what they're expecting. It's certainly not what they're wanting. But Jesus replies. And Jesus says, "Let me ask you a question. Answer me this, and then I'll tell you by what authority I'm doing these things. John's baptism, was it from heaven or of human origin? Tell me that." Why does he ask about John's baptism? What's that got to do with anything? In the midst of this, what has John's baptism got to do with anything? Well, it's like this. Before Jesus began his ministry, the last problem that the Sanhedrin had to deal with was John the Baptist. Because we read in Luke chapter 3 that it was during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas, so the same two people who are around now, who are probably part of this conversation with Jesus, the same two men, Annas and Caiaphas, it was during their high priesthood that John the Baptist exercised his ministry. And because they are the highest religious authority in the land, it was their duty to check John out and see whether he was okay, to check whether he was kosher, so to speak. And we know they did that, because the Bible tells us, John chapter 1, the Jewish leaders in Jerusalem, the Sanhedrin, sent priests and Levites to ask John who he was. So they'd gone and checked John out. And John had said, "I'm not the Messiah, I'm just the one sent to prepare the way for the Messiah." So they'd gone and checked John out. So it's quite a clever question that Jesus says. Jesus is really saying, "You're asking me about my authority. What about the last person you checked out then? John the Baptist. What did you make of him? Was he from God? Or was he just a man doing his own thing?" And they're caught. What do we say? They talk about it to one another. Mutter, mutter, mutter. If we say, "He was sent from God," he's going to ask us, "So why didn't you believe in him?" If we say, "He's just a man doing his own thing," the crowd's going to kill us. And so the highest political authority in the land, the highest religious authority in the land, the highest legal authority in the land, consider the question, and their answer is, "Don't know. We don't know." It was their job to know. It was their responsibility to know. They should have had an answer, but they duck it. "Oh, we don't know, we don't know." So Jesus is quite blunt and says, "So I won't tell you then who I am and why I'm doing these things, but I will tell you a story. Let me tell you a story. And he begins to tell them the story of the vineyard. Now, as the leaders, and particularly those of them who were the teachers of the law, they would immediately recognize this story, because it's not a new story. It's an old story that Jesus tells them. It's actually a story that starts in Isaiah chapter 5. Because in Isaiah chapter 5, which if you want to check it out is on page 654, Isaiah says, "I will sing a song for the one I love, a song about his vineyard. My loved one had a vineyard on a fertile hillside. He dug it and cleared it of stones and planted it with the choicest vines. He built a watchtower in it. Then he looked for a crop of good grapes." That's the story that Jesus told. It was a man who had a vineyard, and he dug it, and he built a watchtower, and then at the harvest time, this is what he did. So he's not telling them a new story, he's telling them an old story that they recognize. And they would know from Isaiah chapter 5 what it meant, because Isaiah spelled it out. The vineyard is the house of Israel, and the people of Judah are the vines he delighted in. So in this story that Isaiah told, the vineyard, it's the people of God. And so when Jesus told his story, they knew the story. They knew that from Isaiah 5, he was talking about the people of God. And so Jesus takes the same story, but then he adds to it, and he tells the story a little bit further. And in Jesus' version of the story, he says, the owner of the vineyard, the one that it belongs to, he put farmers in charge. He put tenants in charge of the vineyard. He gave them a delegated authority. He put people with authority to look after God's people. Oh, who might that be? Well, that might be chief priests and teachers of the law and elders who were put in charge to look after God's people. And God, the owner, expects them to do a good job. And so he sends servants to check up on them. From time to time, he'll send messengers to see how they're doing. And throughout the whole of the Old Testament, God kept doing that. He kept sending messengers to check up on how the religious leaders were doing. They were called the prophets. And they would come and they would bring messages from God to the religious leaders. And the last of those prophets, oh, who was that? Oh, that would be John the Baptist, because he came as a prophet from God to see how well they were doing. And how had they treated these servants? Well, many of them had been shamefully treated. The prophets were shamefully treated. Some of them were killed, like John the Baptist. Until finally in the story, Jesus says the owner of the vineyard sent his son, his dearly loved son, hoping that they would respect his son. And the tenants, they know that he is the son. They know that he has authority from the father. But in their twisted and their warped way of thinking, they think, this is the son. This is the heir. If we get rid of him, then this will be ours. So they kill him. But the story doesn't end there. And it doesn't end the way the tenants wanted it to end, because their plan does not work. The owner of the vineyard comes and he kills the tenants and gives the vineyard to others. And then Jesus quotes from another Old Testament passage, Psalm 118, page 589, if you want to check it out. The image switches from a vineyard to a building. And Jesus says, haven't you read this passage of Scripture? The stone the builders rejected became the cornerstone. The Lord has done this, and it's marvelous in our eyes. And the story ends there. And Mark tells us that the chief priests and the teachers of the law looked for a way to arrest him because they knew he'd spoken the parable against them. But they were afraid of the crowd, so they left him and went away. I think this is probably the only one of the parables of Jesus that is pointedly aimed at one specific group of people. And they knew it. They knew he was telling this story about them. They are the tenant farmers. John the Baptist is one of those servants whom God sent. And they know that Jesus is saying, and I am the Son that God has sent, and I know what you are planning to do to me. He's letting them know he knows exactly what their intentions are. He knows that their hope is to get rid of him. He knows that their plan is to kill him, and he is saying to them, even though you do that, your plan will not succeed. Because even though they reject Jesus and get rid of him, even though they kill him, God's purpose will be fulfilled, as we know from the rest of the gospel gloriously that it was, that he was raised from the dead and that he became the chief cornerstone. He was set as the one who would build his church and from whom the whole church would be shaped. And Jesus is telling them, your plan will not succeed. The whole point of the whole incident is that Jesus is king. The members of the Sanhedrin thought that they were the highest authority. And Jesus, in his reply to them and in this parable, is saying to them, no, God is the highest authority, and I am sent by him, and so I am the highest authority. I am the king. And in one level, that's what the whole story of Mark's gospel is about. If you remember when we began the series on Mark months ago, the way in which the gospel starts says this is the start of a new era. There's a new king in town. And the whole of the gospel is this story of how Jesus is God's king. And his baptism is really his coronation and his anointing as king. And the story builds throughout Mark. There's a new king, there's a new king, there's a new king. And the riding into Jerusalem is a part of that. And Jesus clearing the temple is part of Jesus acting as king and coming into conflict with those who thought that they were in charge. So when Jesus rides into Jerusalem, he's not usurping their authority. He is the higher authority. He is king. When Jesus clears the temple, he's not going into their patch. He's going into his patch and dealing with something that he has the right to deal with, because he says, this is my Father's house. I'm in charge here. Whether they like it or not, the story for them is Jesus is king. And even if they try and get rid of him, he will still end up as king. That was the point for them. And that's the point for us of having this story in the gospel. To remind us, as we need to be reminded again and again and again, that Jesus is king. He is in charge. He has authority. Paul spells it out so clearly, doesn't he, in Ephesians 1, when he says, God the Father raised Christ from the dead and seated him at his right hand in the heavenly realms, far above all rule and authority, power and dominion, and every name that can be invoked, not only in the present age, but also in the one to come. And God placed all things under his feet and appointed him to be head over everything. There is nothing that is not included in all things and everything. And it's not just in the present age, it's in the one to come. It's now and forever, and it's all things. Jesus has been appointed as head over all things. He's king. He has authority. He's been given authority by God. Now, I think the thing that upset the members of the Sanhedrin the most was when Jesus went into the temple and exercised his authority there. You see, Palm Sunday, they could put that down to mass hysteria. The crowd just got carried away. That wasn't what Jesus meant. The crowd just got carried away. They could, if they wanted to, reinterpret that one. And we'll forget that one. But when he went into the temple, their domain, where their headquarters were, and when he exercised his authority there, that's when they really got upset. That's when they wanted to get rid of him, because as far as he was concerned, that was their domain. We're in charge here. You can't come in here and tell us what to do. We're in charge here. It was when he went into the temple that they really got upset. So what's the temple that Jesus might come into now? and take control over and run the risk of upsetting us? Well, the New Testament uses that image of a temple in two ways. It says, first of all, we, the people of God together, the church, are the temple. It was Luke Tebb, our former worship pastor, who used to say, we do not gather at the temple, we gather as the temple. This building is not a temple, but we, the people of God together, are the temple of God. It's in Ephesians 2, it's in 1 Corinthians 3. This is God's temple. This is one of those temples. We together are one of those places where Jesus is king. Jesus has authority in the church. Just in case you ever made the mistake of thinking it, church is not a democracy. It is not a place where we are in charge, but where he is in charge. It's a Christocracy. It's Jesus in charge. But like the members of the Sanhedrin, we have to be very, very careful that we don't start thinking of it as ours, that this is our domain where we're in charge. That's the language we use. We can't help it. We talk about our church. If you're a church leader, you might even talk about my church. But it's not mine and it's not ours. It's his church. And we make the mistake that we start to think that what I want is important, or what I like is important, or what I think is important, and therefore should happen. Church is where Jesus is meant to be in charge. It's what he wants. It's what he likes. It's what he thinks is important that matters. Some of you are, like me, old enough to remember the ministry of John Wimber. And when John Wimber first visited the UK, the message that he felt God had given him for the UK church was this: I want my church back. And that message from God was that sense of, you've treated it as if it was yours, but I want it back. It's my church. And when John was faced with many people who used to speak to him about what they wanted from a church, he used to ask, when does God get what he wants from a church? And for us, as the people of God, facing probably the biggest change in the history of St. Bees as we consider this relocation to the high road, but more than just the relocation of the building, what it will mean for us in terms of how we do church and what we look like and what we think is important and what will happen and all of those things, we do need to keep reminding ourselves, this isn't ours, it's his. This is a temple that he has the right to come into and declare his authority over. What does he want church to look like? But the other way in which the New Testament uses the image of the temple is that it uses it of us individually. It tells us in 1 Corinthians 6 that our bodies, we individually, our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. So that means Jesus is not just king over the church, he's not just king over us together, he's king over us individually, of our individual lives. He has authority over us individually. And just as with the church, we have to be careful that we don't fall into the same trap of the members of the Sanhedrin and start thinking, this temple's mine. And that really goes against the spirit of the age, doesn't it? Because we talk of self-awareness and self-image and self-determination and self-actualization and self-this and self-that. And we speak about my life and my future and my career and that most important thing of all, my happiness. And we can start to think that it's ours. Paul is brutally clear in 1 Corinthians 6. He says, you are not your own. You do not belong to you. You are not your own. You were bought with a price. Jesus is king over us individually and over us together. He's been given authority. He's been pointed as head over everything. That includes the church. It includes us. So the challenge from this passage is, are we going to react in the way that the chief priests and the elders and the teachers of the law reacted. In other words, are we going to challenge his right to rule in those areas? Are we going to effectively say to Jesus, who gave you authority to rule over this church or over our lives? Who died and made you king? Slightly poignant, that, isn't it? He died and God made him king. So are we going to be like the rulers of Jesus' day who thought they were in charge, and when Jesus came and said, no, I'm in charge, challenged him with their questions? Or are we going to do the opposite, which is simply to bow our knee to Jesus and acknowledge that he is in charge, that he is king, that he died and God made him king over us together and over us individually? Alice and the band just want to make their way back up. Going to lead us in a song in a moment. I want to give you the opportunity this morning to just let the Spirit of God speak to you and for you to respond. Because I do believe there is a real challenge from God to each one of us in this passage. And it is that simple challenge that I've given you. Are we going to challenge Jesus about his right to rule over us together, or his right to rule over us individually? It may be that for some of us, we have been doing that. We've been challenging his right to rule over his church, where we've thought that what we want is more important than what he wants. What we like is more important than what he likes. And we have challenged his right to rule over his church. And being like the Israelites in the days of the judges, who behave as if there was no king and everyone does what is right in their own eyes, maybe even in terms of what happens in church, sometimes we've put what we want and what we like above what he wants and what he likes. And we've challenged his authority. Maybe we've done that in our own lives. Maybe there have been areas of our own life where we've said, what right does he have to challenge me about that? Maybe that challenge came through a brother or sister who had the courage to challenge you about something in your life that you're doing, that they said, is that really what God wants? And your reaction has been almost, what right does he have? The answer is, he has every right. And so if there have been areas where you know you have been challenging his right, I want to invite you in a moment, when Alice and the band lead us in a song, I want to invite you to just make an act of response and an act of submission, which is simply to come and kneel at the front. There'll be plenty of room. But if you feel that in some way you've been resisting his right to rule, either in something to do with church or in something in your own life individually, just to invite you to come and kneel at the front as we sing the song. Or it may be that you just want to reaffirm that basic commitment to Jesus, to say, I'm not aware of any area that I've specifically been challenging you about, but I do want to tell you again this morning that for the rest of my days, my intention is to live my life under your rule and under your reign. And you too might want to come and kneel at the front. And if that means everybody comes, then we'll find room for you. But if you feel that that's not something you need to do, then that's fine. So if you sense that you just need to make that response to Jesus this morning that says, I'm not going to challenge your right. I'm not going to say, who do you think you are? I'm not going to say, who died and made you king? I'm going to say to you, you died and God made you king, and I accept your right to rule over this church and over my life. Then as Alice starts to play and lead us in a song that you may not even recognize, because it's quite an old song. It's a wonderful one. King of Kings, Majesty, all within me falls at your throne. Then as we sing it, just come and kneel at the front as an act of response to the fact that Jesus is King.